We have some members that are tied up in some other places, so we're going to open up some public hearings and get rolling, and our members will come wandering in as the mood strikes them. Call the House Committee on Health Care to order for April 27th and open up a public hearing on House Bill 94A. What do we got?
Mr. Chair, what we have is Senate Bill 94A came to us from the Senate side with a 28-aye vote to excuse from the floor. It authorizes the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt uniform standards for healthcare financial and administrative transactions, including uniform standards for four components: eligibility, inquiry and response, claim submission, payment, remittance advice, claims payment or electronic funds transfer, claim status, injury response, claims attachment, prior authorization, provider credentialing, or other health care financial and administrative transactions identified by a stakeholder work group. And we have some folks here to testify, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Let's get started. Oh, we have a bunch of people.
Yeah.
We have...
They'll be from...
Blankenship, is that Marion?
No.
That's the first name? Did I get it right?
Yeah.
Okay, and who do you want to bring somebody else up? Yeah. Bartel is next. Yeah, why don't we have the two of you, and the next group will have, is that right? Tom Holt, Janine Smith, and Patty O'Sullivan in the next group. Go for it.
Okay. Good afternoon. Co-chairs Thompson and Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Marion Blankenship. I am the Director of Government Relations and the Executive Director of the Charitable Foundation for Pacific Source. That's still a relatively new title for me, so I'm practicing. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 94A. Pacific Source Health Plan supports reducing the cost of providing health care by decreasing the amount of administrative costs among providers, hospitals, and health plans. We believe there is an opportunity to drive down administrative costs through standardization and automation of key transactions, such as those identified in Senate Bill 94A. We do believe that in order to achieve maximum benefit, everyone in the system really needs to participate. The bill helps to bring all parties into participation for utilizing the standards. It does include third-party administrators and self-funded groups, and we think this is necessary and important given the number of Oregonians that are covered by self-funded insurance. Thus far, the process that's really in place currently for establishing uniform standards has been a public-private partnership. We think this is an effective structure. It provides the forum for building standards that can work for everyone. Pacific Source Health Plans has been a part of that process, and we would like to continue to do so going forward, and we urge the committee's support of Senate Bill 94A. Thank you.
Is there anybody from DCBS here? Okay. Any questions?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of Senate Bill 94A. My name is Deborah Bartel, and I'm the clinic administrator for Portland Diabetes and Endocrinology Center. I'm a physician-owned medical clinic with two locations in Portland. I'm also the legislative liaison for the Oregon Medical Group Managers Association. Before joining PDEC as their clinic administrator, I worked as an information technology consultant with medical clinics and other organizations. You have my written testimony, so I'm not just going to read through it. I thought I'd mention that I've been part of several of the administrative simplification committees that have included not only providers but hospitals and health insurance companies. It's for the last couple of years, everybody from those entities has been working really hard to come up with something that will work for us. several years ago when HIPAA became popular and became into law, we were pretty excited that now there was going to be a standard transaction for us to use when sending our claims and receiving electronic responses back. Unfortunately, it turned out to be more of a guideline than a requirement. And so we have some folks that think rendering provider is the person that actually was face-to-face with the patient. Some folks want us to send in rendering provider the name of the clinic. So we still have 1,500 different organizations we work with that may or may not accept the same thing in the specific area of the transaction, and that has made our lives very difficult. In addition to those types of transactions, we're excited to work with the health plans and the hospitals on improving administrative simplification for credentialing for providers. Typically, if we add a new provider to our clinic, it takes 80 hours of staff time and about 6 months in order to get that completed with all the entities we must credential them with. Most of it is continual repetition of the same things, the same forms to fill out, sending them to the different places, calling them over and over again after they've lost them and resending them. So we're very excited about the prospect of simplifying that as well. So again, thank you very much for allowing me to come and testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Well, thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay. Who do we have? Tom Holt, Denise Smith, Patty O'Sullivan. This is a requirement for the Oregon Health Authority, right, to gather together a group and make recommendations to DHS, to DCBS. Yes. It's not a requirement for DCBS to accept them. Is that right?
Shall I go ahead? Chair Greenwoods and Thompson.
This is Dave.
I'm Janine Smith, the Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research inside the Health Authority, and I have testimony that I didn't hand off, but maybe Tom can help me here. What this bill is a sort of extends what you already had asked us to do in House Bill 2009. We had an administrative simplification work group working public-private partners to work on some recommendations to help streamline, you know, some initial steps towards administrative simplification. That was then handed off to the Division for Consumer and Business Services. What this bill does is allow that to then be applied across to all payers and encourages us to keep doing that kind of systematic, where we have the work group help develop across public-private the standards and help solve some of the issues you just heard about over time. This can include prior authorization and other things that we could start to stepwise streamline. And so the essence of this bill is really just to keep doing what we've been doing in partnership with the work that the health authority sort of convened the work group, then the DCBS uses its authority to actually make it happen. We want to ensure that there's continued stakeholder involvement in this and that all sides are heard and what seems reasonable, practical, and feasible. And the essence of this is it could really help to save some dollars, both in terms of amount of FTE on both sides of whatever those processes are, be it billing in both the insurance side, company carrier side, or the offices sides. So the essence really is to do all the things that we want to do, which is a more efficient way to have the health care system work. So I outlined some of these in my testimony, and that really is what the essence of this bill is.
And you don't have the authority to do this now?
We have the authority to do it on a one-time basis, but what this really gives is, okay, DCBS to do it across all payers. So it just keeps the process going and expands it.
Any other questions for Dr. Smith?
No. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Co-Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, here in support of Senate Bill 94A. I think Janine and Marion have explained very well what it actually does. I'd just throw in our two cents that we're very pleased that this is something that's building on a process that to this point has been primarily focused on, you know, Oregon carriers and the other stakeholders in Oregon, and gets us, you know, real simplification across the whole market through a good stakeholder process. So we're very confident that this process will work well, so we've been able to test sled it before we have a bill. So with that, I'll close.
I understand there's some amendments coming. You guys know anything about that? Or there may be.
Mr. Chair, I've heard a rumor about amendments. Let me make a couple brief comments, please. And then I'll go forward. For the record, I am not Patty O'Sullivan. I just want to make sure that's very clear.
Except for the hair, dude.
Thank you very much. I'm going to refrain from saying anything else right
now. That was on the record.
Several thoughts crossed my mind. But one of the lessons the lobbyists learned is when to shut up, so I'm going to practice that. Mr. Chair, for the record, Dave Fiskum here for Providence Health System. My colleague Patty O'Sullivan from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems is down the hall testifying on a different bill, so she would have spoken for me or me for her to indicate that we are in support of Senate Bill 94. We believe this will, as has been described very well, standardize, simplify administration, and focus more attention on improving care and quality while also helping to control costs. I would say just briefly that the part of the impetus here, by no means the entire emphasis, emerged with healthcare organizations in the Portland metropolitan area, including my client, Providence Health System, which has been together with a number of other organizations dealing with administrative simplification, credentialing, prior authorization issues, and we're pleased to support this bill. I want to compliment the Oregon Health Authority and all of its staff for being willing to work with us on the Senate side to produce a better bill than the original printed bill. Senate Bill 94A appears before you as a consensus bill. There would be a risk, I think, Mr. Chairs, if there were amendments added to the bill at this time, but that's your prerogative to consider, not ours. So.
No, I just heard a rumor, too, so I don't know anything about it. We don't have anything.
The rumor I heard is that there's one bill which was dead in the Senate, which might, the provisions of that piece of legislation, somebody might have had the idea of inserting them in this bill. Proposing for them to be inserted in this bill, and I will leave that to them as opposed to describing that for you. We would hope that this bill could pass in its current form because it does represent, I believe, a consensus of a wide variety of interests who have come together. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Well, we have a quorum.
No.
Yeah?
Yeah, we do.
I was just saying not move it.
Not move it. Okay, great. We'll find out what's going on.
Well, I was asked not to.
Oh, okay.
Pending amendments, so I'll contact and make sure.
Oh,
I kind of thought we'd have them today, so we haven't. I don't know why. So.
Great.
On the S drive, well, they're showing some Senate amendments here that weren't part of it, but I'm not sure if those are the ones that are being discussed.
The Senate amendment were part of it, right? Were there some Senate amendments that weren't?
Yeah.
Right.
I think he's correct that these had to do with a bill that some similar subject or something didn't make it out of the Senate, and it would fit into this one possibly. I have not seen the amendments. I don't
okay. Well,
and then just for the record, I did want to make clear that Ms. O'Sullivan is back, but it allowed me to speak for her to say that this entire hospital association is, in fact, in favor of this bill, if that wasn't clear.
In this form.
Yes, thank you. In this form. Thank you.
And Mr. Co-Chair, if I may, our preference also will be for the bill to pass as it is at this point in time.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 94A and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 95A. And Dr. Smith, don't go too far. Mickey Alexander?
Right.
Can I see this one?
Sure.
Frequent flyer today, Janine.
Co-Chair Greenlick and Thompson, this is like old times in the last session. And members of the committee. I am Janine Smith, Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research in the Oregon Health Authority, and I have the pleasure of being accompanied by J. Michael Alexander, alias Mick Alexander, the co-chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board's Task Force on Medical Liability. And what Senate Bill 95A was the work of that task force, and this bill is part of the recommendations that came out of the Oregon Health Policy Board's action plan. So I was going to turn it over to Mick to just talk for a brief moment about the task force. Some of you have heard a little bit about this on the Wednesday night activities, but just so for the rest of the committee.
Co-Chair Greenlee, Co-Chair Thompson, and members of the committee, I'm Mick Alexander. I was the co-chair of the task force. Dr. Semenchik, incidentally, is in Seattle. He regrets not being able to be here as well, but he's just been out of state for a lot of these meetings. I did want to point out, and it's in your written material, that the task force undertook kind of a different approach, and that was to look at patient-centered reform. In other words, some legislation that would meet the three goals of the liability system becoming a more effective tool for improving patient safety, a better tool for compensating victims, and also reducing collateral costs associated with the liability system. One of the things that we considered, and I'm glad to see Ms. Mooney here to testify to you because she was very instrumental in bringing a lot of information to the task force about the way that early disclosure and offer really fulfills all of these three goals quite effectively. It's really kind of a win-win situation. And what that does is that when there is a sentinel event or a medical error, is that the hospital brings it to the attention of the patient and then tries to reach an early agreement on settlement. And that seems to, like I say, fulfill all of these goals. One of the impediments that the task force, or at least potential impediments that the task force recognized to this policy is that some insurance companies might look at making that form of disclosure to a patient as violating the cooperation clause of the policy and therefore voiding coverage. How prevalent that may be or not, I don't know, but I guess if I was advising an insurance client, an insured, I would at least warn them about that possibility. So this bill just, in very simple terms, just says an insurance company cannot use the disclosure of this information to either deny coverage under the duty to defend or the corresponding duty to pay. And that's why the task force thought it was a good idea to sponsor this legislation.
And the studies indicate that the way to prevent more malpractice is to apologize when there's a mistake. Explain what you're doing.
There's some early research, Chair Greenlee, that in terms of that might help to reduce the actual litigation as well as the costs of that. So that, hence the reasons and that it was passed on the Senate side. It was at least, it's not the whole answer to, but it is a key aspect of medical liability.
Co-Chair Greenlee, Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee, that is one of the fascinating things about looking at this early disclosure and offer. It seems to be truly a win-win situation. The patient comes out better. The institution learns more through their transparency, and claims are reduced.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty good idea.
State.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Greenlee and Thompson. My name is Gwen Dayton. I'm General Counsel with the Oregon Medical Association. I'll just briefly say that the OMA does support this bill in the Angros version. For all the reasons you've heard, the OMA believes that transparency between physicians and their patients is just basic and critical to that care. This bill helps remove some of the barriers to that by requiring defense and indemnification when there's a claim that involves a disclosure of an adverse event, and also strengthening the I'm sorry law in Oregon to be a little bit broader than it is right now. We think those are good things. That we think they promote good patient care and transparency between providers and patients. It's a good thing. We support it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Somebody else?
Yeah, there's
two. Oh, there's more. Oh, falling asleep here. What else we got? Deborah Heron? Jody Mooney Peace Health? No, that's not the name. And that's it. Let's go.
Co-
Co-Chair Greenlee, Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee, I'm Deborah Herron here on behalf of Peace Health in support of Senate Bill 95. Joining us today is Jody Mooney, who is the attorney and director of risk management and organizational integrity for Peace Health Oregon Region. As mentioned in previous testimony, she was also appointed to the Oregon Health Policy Board's Medical Liability Task Force, which met during the 2010 interim session over a period of months and is part of the work that went into creating this bill. I'll now turn the testimony over to Jody, who will share with you some of Peace Health's experiences.
So, Co-Chairs Greenlee and Thompson and members of the committee, I'm Jody Mooney, and I work for Peace Health in Eugene, Springfield, as their Director of Risk Management. I've been in the role for about 6 years. Before that, I worked for 17 years in private practice, primarily defending civil litigation with a large focus on defending providers, hospitals, physicians, and nurses in medical malpractice cases. Appreciate the opportunity to come here today and to talk to you about Peace Health's journey. Peace Health supports Senate Bill 95A, not because it's a particularly revolutionary bill, but because it will extend to hospitals the same protection that physicians currently have, where apologies are protected and by statute can't be used as an admission of liability if there's a later claim made against the physician. The Senate Bill 95A would also add protection for providers against liability insurance carriers that might otherwise deny coverage based upon a statement made by a physician or provider that they were sorry for an error that had occurred. We also support the bill because it encourages hospitals to do the right thing, to be open and honest with patients when something has happened during the course of their care. At Peace Health, we've decided as an organization to do the right thing when such things happen, even though under the current I'm sorry law, hospitals are not per se protected. We've adopted what I call a philosophy of care that includes early disclosure and offer in cases of clear liability. When a mistake that occurs at the hospital has actually harmed a patient, we tell the patient about that right away. We disclose that. We tell them that we're sorry that it happened. And we try to engage in settlement negotiations as early as we can. We try to initiate that process before the patient is in the position of having to come to us with a demand. This approach, you know, to me and to many of the people I work with seems obvious and simple, and it is, and it should be, but historically it hasn't been the automatic default because of concern for liability. Peace Health, so you understand what we're talking about in our program, we define a sentinel event broadly. We define it more broadly than the Joint Commission requires us to. Basically, it's in something that happens that's unanticipated, that is thought to be usually preventable. It's related to the treatment that's actually provided to the patient, and it causes injury or death. So the important thing for us is that when we call something a sentinel event at the hospital, it means we do two things. We engage in disclosure and apology right away, and we pull together a multidisciplinary team, and we do a root cause analysis. We try to figure out what went wrong. The focus of that review is not like the focus in the traditional civil justice system. It's a focus not on blame, but on what are the underlying factors or conditions of the delivery system itself that we might be able to enhance, beef up a little bit so that in the future the error is less likely to actually result in harm to a patient. So, you know, the one thing that we know in the work that we do is that human error is 100% predictable. Human error is 100% predictable. The goal of the process is not to eliminate error. The goal is to make sure that we learn from our mistakes in a way that allows us to enhance our systems so that the next time an error like that happens, we don't end up causing harm to our patients. going to, I provided you with written testimony here, and I'm not going to read the whole thing to you because I know you can read. I would like to, it's a little bit lengthy, but what I wanted to do is give you an example, if it would be helpful, so you can see how this works or has worked for us at Peace Health. And I don't mean to suggest that Peace Health is the only organization that does this. We happen to do it, and that's where I work, and so I can talk to you about that. We, by way of example, we had a patient who came in for a procedure on an emergent basis. He required a cardiac stent to be placed, and an order was written by the physician to administer a certain medication after the procedure was done. The order didn't get administered, and so the patient ended up, the medication was for the purpose of preventing reocclusion or clotting. Because the medication wasn't given, the patient experienced clotting and had to go back to the cath lab where an additional stent was placed. And there was documented damage to the heart muscle as a result of the additional episode. We were upfront with the patient from the beginning about what happened. We did a root cause analysis, and we shared the findings of the analysis with him. We changed an order set. We modified a nursing process and presented that to him so that he could see that some improvements had been made as a result of this event. I encouraged him to seek legal counsel, which he did. We spoke with the patient and his lawyer at that point, entered into a voluntary mediation. We were able to mediate the basically reach agreement on a number for compensation very quickly. And the interesting part for me as a defense lawyer and as a risk manager is at the end of the mediation, we had a judge here in Salem who assisted us with that. The patient wanted to make sure that we all came together in the room at the end, and we did that. And before I knew it, he was embracing me in a large bear hug. And so we had actually developed a positive relationship with this patient as we went through the process, despite the fact that we had harmed him when he came to us for care. He was appreciative of the whole process. He came and spoke to our board, and we actually still have coffee occasionally. Now, that doesn't happen with every patient that we go through this process with, but it is an example of how kind of doing the right thing actually works for everybody. It's a win-win situation. He comes back to us for care, and he's comfortable to do that, and he knows that he can expect to be treated in an ethical and appropriate way. And sort of what this bill does, as I said at the beginning, it's not particularly revolutionary, but it allows healthcare providers and facilities to continue to do the work that Peace Health and others are doing, along the lines of what I've just described, with some protection in place, and that it seems to me that that's a good thing for everybody.
Can you wrap it up?
If you have any questions, I'd be happy to take your questions.
No, that's very clear.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Great. Sounds like a great plan.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think the other members may want to vote on this one. So we will close the public hearing and we'll open up a work session, and I hope move it. We get a couple more members with us. So let's open up a work session. A public hearing on Senate Bill 104. And Chair, what do we got here?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 104 comes to the committee from the Senate Healthcare Committee and off of the Senate floor with 24 ayes, 6 noes. This eliminates the investment and savings limits from the definition of eligible individual in the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, otherwise known as FEHAP. It removes the definition of family and allows the Office of Private Health Partnerships to adopt a definition by rule. It authorizes the Office of Private Health Partnerships to adopt dental-only plans, and it does some other things within FEHAP. I won't read the whole thing, Mr. Chair.
We'll ask our witnesses to tell us what it does.
That's right.
Who's first?
I guess I am.
Go for it.
Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Tom Jovic. I'm the administrator of the Office of Private Health Partnerships in the Oregon Health Authority. Senate Bill 104 really has a number of technical adjustments to the Office of Private Health Partnerships, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, or FEHOP, which we administer, and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, or OMIP, which we also administer. It also makes some changes to public health statutes, and my colleague will be talking about those.
Is this basically your annual cleanup bill?
Basically, cleanup. I'll be very brief. So, for the FEHOP program, for those of you who don't know, this is a program that provides health insurance subsidies to low-income individuals and families so they can purchase either group or individual health insurance coverage in the commercial market. There are four provisions in this bill that affect the FEHOP program. Two of them basically put us in compliance with federal requirements. One of those...
That's not bad.
Yeah, that's good. One of those basically eliminates assets as an eligibility criterion. What that does is it makes the state eligible for performance bonuses in the CHIP program, the Child Health Insurance Program. The other allows us to provide subsidies for individual dental plans under the current statute. We can only subsidize dental plans that are part of an employer-based insurance program. The provision about the definition of family, basically what it would do is, rather than define family in the statute, is allow us to define it in rule. And the reason we feel that is important is that with us having become part of the health authority, it allows us to be consistent with definitions of family within the health authority. It also allows us to modify our definition of family as federal legislation changes that definition. And finally, there is a provision that would allow us to establish in rule guidelines for recovering subsidy overpayments. There's a question about whether the current statute really gives us the ability to get those overpayments. And so what this would allow us to do is to clarify under what circumstances we would recover overpayments and how we would do that. For the Office of Private Health Partnerships, one of the provisions simply eliminates language that relates to an obsolete program that sunset in 2008. The other allows us, as an organization, to contract for individual and group benefit plans in addition to certifying those plans as eligible for subsidies. And along with that, it then allows us to establish what the premium levels are that we would subsidize. It would allow us to establish what requirements there would be for an employer participation in order for us to subsidize an employer's health insurance program. And it would allow us to assure that the subsidies we pay are for programs that meet minimal benefit coverage. For OMIP, I don't know if all of you know what OMIP is. It is the state's high-risk pool. There are four provisions affecting that program. One simply restores a board position that was taken up by the director of the Oregon Health Authority. At the last session, the legislature made that a board position, but it inadvertently didn't give another position for the board. So what happened was the director took a position that we already had filled. So this simply restores that position. This bill also puts us in conformance with the procurement and contracting requirements and processes that exist within the Oregon Health Authority. It also gives the board the authority to extend the current contract with the third-party administrator so that it ends at the time the federal reforms take place in January of 2014. The current contract ends at January 31st, 2013. And without this provision, The OMIP board would have to initiate a relatively lengthy procurement process for the third-party administrator that would culminate in a contract that would take effect in February of 2013 and would only last 11 months. And finally, this bill would allow us to continue coverage for individuals who become eligible for Medicare but for whatever reason do not enroll in Part B or Part D coverage in Medicare. And what we would do is keep them on coverage until the next open enrollment periods, at which time we would expect them to get that coverage. Without this provision, these folks would be at risk of having no coverage for outpatient services or for drugs. And so we think it's a reasonable provision to have in the OMIP.
Great.
And that's basically it. Happy to answer any questions.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going through this, and I'm trying to figure out how it doesn't have a fiscal attached to it. So, because it looks like we're expanding or adding coverage to people, to bring more people into the program. So,
into are you talking about FIAP program? Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener. It doesn't necessarily expand the program. It just gives us the ability to contract for coverage for benefit plans. It in addition to certifying those plans. The way FIAP operates is the enrollments are basically controlled by budget. So we pretty much know what premium amounts are that we subsidize, and we can basically subsidize coverage until we start to hit our budget limits, and at that point we stop. So this doesn't really expand coverage. It doesn't expand the number of people that we would cover. That is all controlled really by the budget.
How often do we hit the budget limit? So,
well,
because there's a cap there.
There have been, all of a sudden, we cut people off. Chair Greenlick and Thompson, Representative Widener, there have been a number of instances when we have been running up against either a budget constraint or some kind of constraint that was put on the program, say, by the feds. So 2007, we had about 18,500 people in the FIAP program getting subsidies. We had been told by the federal government that we would no longer be able to secure a higher match rate for some of those individuals. What that did was change really what our budget was for this program, because we get federal match for state general funds. And with that cut in federal funds, what we had to do was to stop new enrollments. In addition to that, we had to disenroll about 4,500 people. Now,
most of whom ended up in Medicaid.
Most of them ended up in Medicaid, and that was a result of a collaboration between our program and the folks in the Medicaid program to open up some slots for them. And basically, we gave the people in that had the FIAP subsidies the choice of going over to Medicaid coverage or CHIP coverage if they were kids, or to pay the full freight of the premiums. So the bulk of them went over there. As a result, we lost those 4,500 people. Our current enrollment is about 14,000 right now.
If I may, one more. Reimbursement rates through FIAP versus Medicaid to a dentist, are they the same?
Chair Greenlick and Thompson, Representative Widener's right, Widener, we don't reimburse providers. What we do is subsidize the insurance premium. So if a insurance premium for dental coverage is, say, $60, we will subsidize a portion of that depending upon the income of the people we cover. It's the carrier, the insurance carrier, that negotiates the reimbursement rate with the dentist or the physician or the hospital, so on.
Great. Thank you. Yes.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, Chair Thompson, or Representative Chair Thompson. For the record, my name is Dana Seliver. I am the Section Manager for Healthcare Regulation and Quality Improvement in the Office of Community Health and Health Planning at the Public Health Division, Oregon Health Authority. I'm here today on behalf of Grant Higginson to support a couple of changes also included in Senate Bill 104. The first two have to do with epinephrine for severe allergic reaction. The changes include reducing the age of those who can be trained to administer this from 21 to 18. This is done so that young individuals that are helping out in daycare and in camps also can have this training and able to help children or individuals who are in these situations. The other change is to allow not only physicians, nurses, and nurse practitioners to administer this training, but also to include EMT paramedics in the those who are able to offer this training. Entities that are looking for this training have had a little bit of difficulty finding physicians, nurses, and nurse practitioners to do this, so we'd like to open this up to EMT paramedics who do this as part of their practice. The other change is for caregiver registries. Last session, we created a program.
I thought it said hypoglycemia.
No, epinephrine for a severe allergic reaction.
Bee stings.
Sorry.
Sorry.
These
things and whatnot.
Well, yeah, no, I know right. I just must have misread the question. Go ahead, please.
Okay. The final change is for caregiver registries. There are two minor changes. One is a definitional change that was agreed upon in a group of stakeholders that changed the definition to more clearly reflect what these caregiver registries do. It also eliminates an entity called referral agencies that were thought to exist at the time the legislation passed, and we discovered there aren't any in Oregon, so we're removing those.
Do you have a copy of the bill?
I do.
Could you look on page, what is that?
Page 5.
Page 5, line 38 through 43. Mm-hmm. Does that say hypoglycemia?
Chair Greenlink, yes it does.
Is there also epi training in here?
That's above. Oh,
that's right. That's here. The treatment of allergic response.
No, that's over here. Line 21 is the epi. And I don't have a problem with it because, in fact, hypoglycemia is a really important thing to know how to deal with. But.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, I'm sorry, I am a stand-in today, so I looked at the bill.
We'll forgive you.
We analyzed it.
Glucagon is the right treatment, so it is hypoglycemia.
Yeah, it's also epi is up above
on
the same
but
page.
Yeah, so right. Just another addition in there.
So those are both important things to train for.
Yeah.
I'll never doubt you again, Mr. Chair.
That's yes. Why. And my mind is frequently wrong, but never in doubt.
Yeah.
Hypoglycemia caused by bee stings.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's what I was talking about. Yeah, right.
Are there any other questions? Should we have a work session on this? Okay. Close the public hearing?
Mr. Chair, we may not want to. So there's a couple things I want to check on this because.
Okay.
With a couple other people. So.
Okay, yeah. So we will. Let's hold over this bill.
We can just reschedule it one day next week.
Great. All right, excellent.
Yeah. We're not in the carryover mode right now, Mr. Chair.
Way ahead of the game. All right. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 104 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 137.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 137 comes to us from the Senate Healthcare Committee, also off the Senate floor with 28 ayes, 2 excused. This clarifies that a student serving in an internship program that covers both funeral services and embalming must be supervised by a practitioner who has a combination funeral service practitioner and embalmer license. This has no fiscal or revenue, Mr. Chair.
And we have Ms. Gaines with us. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-chairs.
You're going to talk about spreading remains on a cemetery today?
No,
as
not
well?
Today. Not today.
Okay.
Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, for the record, my name is Michelle Gaines. I'm the executive director for the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and I think for the first time I'm here not to talk so much about death but about education. This is a very simple technical fix. All it does is make it clear in the statute that if an intern is serving in an educational program that is a combo program, meaning it's both funeral service and embalming, that their supervisor has that license. That's short and sweet, but I'm here to answer any questions.
Any questions? Yes, sir.
Does it happen often that they don't have the license, or what's the problem where?
When things get thin, when it's difficult to find supervisors, which sometimes can happen, we want to make it clear that that's one requirement that they can't let go of, if you will.
I mean, I've been to a number of funerals, and I wasn't aware of whether I was talking to an embalmer or a funeral director, but I'll ask about their license next time.
I'm not going to comment on that. I got all sorts of smart answers.
This will deteriorate quickly.
Yes,
I'm happy with the bill and love to work it.
Yes.
All right. We will close the public hearing on House Bill, on Senate Bill 137. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 137.
Do you want to make a motion?
Yes.
Motion, Mr. Co-Chair.
Chair Greenlick, I move Senate Bill, I'll get organized here. Senate Bill 137 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves Senate Bill 137 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Representative Hoyle would like to know where everybody's at.
Two are in another committee. They'll be along, but.
And one is.
And yeah. One is somewhere else.
That's okay. I'm ready to vote.
With that, I'm very happy with this bill. It's probably the best bill we've seen all day.
I like simple bills, yeah.
Would you call a roll before this gets even worse?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative
Harris?
Excuse.
Representative
Hale? Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Yes.
Vice Chair Kenner?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Kenner?
Excuse.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries.
Do you want this on the consent?
Yeah. Any objection putting this on the consent calendar?
Good bill should pass.
Good bill should pass. Put it on the consent calendar, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 137. We'll open up later to ask our colleagues to have a chance to vote on it. Close the work session on Senate Bill 137. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 138.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Senate Bill 138 made it off of the Senate floor with 26 ayes and 3 noes. This measure expands the authority of the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Medicine during disciplinary proceedings to allow the board to assess costs of those proceedings and impose other disciplinary action the board finds proper. This has an emergency clause and it is effective on passage. We have one person, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And there is no revenue, but there is a fiscal impact statement issued on it, but it does not necessarily have a fiscal attached to that statement. So please review.
Ms. Welch?
Good afternoon, please. Co-Chair Greenlick and Thompson. For the record, my name is Ann Walsh. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Naturopathic Medicine. I'm here today to represent the board and ask your support for Senate Bill 138. The board has, the number of licensees has increased from January 1999 of about 225 to now we have in January of this year over 925 licensees. The numbers alone speak to more complaints coming to the board, and the more complaints you have, the more contested cases you have when you have to issue proposed discipline. This is becoming, it has actually eaten up all of the cash reserves the board has ever had, and we now have to look at some other way of covering those costs. We have to, it's our responsibility to conduct hearings when a licensee requests it after discipline has been issued, and we need to pay the costs for the AG and the administrative hearings and other costs that are involved with that. I think that there is some concern that this bill would be serving such a small profession with only 900 plus licensees may have a bias towards some of the doctors, and I think I've heard that there's a concern that we would discipline a doctor as retribution or punitively. And I wanted to let you know that in 2000, I started a process where a licensee's name is redacted from the complaint before it ever goes to the board. So they only look at the issues involved with that complaint. So there can't be a bias. They can't make a determination on how they're going to react to it. This came about because we did have one shortly after I came to the board. We had a complaint, and I took it to the board as I normally would, and I had a board member go, "Oh, him, he's a cowboy. We'll just talk to him about it." And I'm like, you know, I think we have in the past, and we maybe need to do more. At that point, I thought, it's just too hard for the board members to not be impartial when they know who it is. You just can't help but help your friends. So anyway, other licensing agencies already have this authority in their statute. I'm not necessarily asking for it to use it. The other health licensing agencies that have it have used it in very rare occasions. But I think having the language there encourages the licensee to talk to the board about the concerns the board has presented and talk about options of discipline if they don't agree with those. The board's decisions. And if you have any questions, I'm willing to answer them.
Well, I have one.
Certainly.
Line 15 says, in disciplining a person, the board may undo these things.
Uh-huh.
Does that mean they've been found guilty?
Yes.
So you couldn't impose the cost of a disciplinary process if they were exonerated or whatever the term is?
Correct, Chair Greenlick. That's part of the proposed notice of discipline we would send to them, would say what the board is proposing to do for the violations the board has found. The licensee then has the opportunity to say, to dispute those, and there would be no discipline if the board found that they were in actuality incorrect in their allegations or violations.
That would mitigate the discipline, so the discipline would go away and you couldn't charge them for that?
We would not.
I've heard from, not your board members, but professions and other places, that they think this is used to essentially intimidate people not to take contested case hearings. Is that... Do you have any feeling about that? I mean, you've said, here, you're guilty, we're going to...
Right, yeah. Chair Greenlock
and if you contest this, it could cost you $15,000 for attorney fees.
Well, I guess I have also heard that as well, Representative Greenlock and members of the committee, but I don't believe that is actually... In my research, I have never found that a board has actually... been punitive in that manner or used it as an intimidation factor. Legally, every licensee has a right to contest a hearing, and if they feel the board is bullying them, they should take that next step, which they're also given that right and that information on how to proceed if they feel that the board is inappropriately.
How much is your cost of a contested case hearing?
I think on the handout I gave you, it ranges. Once a licensee can contest a notice of proposed discipline, and if we can resolve it can be resolved sometimes a matter of $500 to $700, only because we have to have our AG look over the documents for a consent order or an agreement that might be reached. We had a case in 2007 that actually settled in 2010 that cost us close to $70,000.
So you could say to this person, not only can I fine you $5,000 and do away with your license, but I can fine you $70,000 as well if you lose this.
Correct.
That's kind of stiff, huh?
It is, but that came out of our pockets, out of our licensee's pockets. And I understand that it doesn't sound fair for the licensee, but in the case that I spoke to, the final determination, which did not actually even go to administrative law judge, we ended up getting the Department of Justice involved and the Board of Medical, Board of Medicine involved as well. He surrendered his license before we ever even got to a hearing for him.
But I heard that a minimum of in a contested case hearing would be about $25,000.
But Chair Greenlick and Thompson, members of the committee, that's not necessarily true. We have had contested case hearings that have cost us $2,000. And that's, you're getting legal advice, number one, to start the process, to give them, provide them with their notice of proposed discipline. You then have to have the Office of Administrative Hearings involved in the setting up, establishing the hearing dates, all of their paperwork as well. You have to pay for an administrative law judge who needs to block time to come and hear the hearing. And then depending upon the complexity of the violations in the case can last anywhere from half a day to 3 or 4 days long for us.
Well, I understand that, but okay. The issue here is you sent your, I'm involved recently with a friend who's a professional on one other board, and it's right in the middle of something like this with a really stupid hearing going on. You're saying to your person who thinks you did something wrong, not only am I as a professional going to have to pay for my lawyer, which is not cheap either, but you're threatening me with the potential, if I lose this, of a lot of money. Now, as it is now, I'm threatening you with the potential, if you've done this in error, and I'm going to take it to contested case hearing, you're going to have to spend that money. And that means you're going to be more interested in settling out of that process as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, this really switches hugely switches the burden to a professional.
Well, Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, most licensees have malpractice insurance, and I realize that they have to pay for that insurance. But that insurance, one of our cases that we just had, that insurance covers a contested case when the license is disciplined by the board. We had a three-day hearing on a contested case, and I won't say it was frivolous, but I'll say that it was unnecessary. But I was told by a person closely involved with the case that the reason that they decided to contest it was they paid for this insurance, and they had $60,000 to spend if that's what they needed to prove the board wrong. They ended up not proving the board wrong. We only disciplined them for what we had originally talked to them about disciplining them for, and yet we were out. It actually cost us like $20,000 for that hearing.
Representative Hoyle?
When I first was appointed to the health care committee, I had the great pleasure of being appointed to the licensing reset board. And one of the things we talked about was how do smaller boards defend themselves in kinds of cases like this? How do they afford to protect consumers and go after cases where, again, there's not a lot of money because you're a smaller board, and the ALJs tend to rotate through pretty often, so you may end up with two or three lawyers in one case. And really, we talked a lot about how the smaller and some of the medium-sized boards are at a disadvantage because they don't have their own in-house counsel. Now, there were a number of suggestions made for how to deal with this, including having a wider pool, including talking with the Attorney General to make sure that we have ALJs that that were consistent and understood the boards and understood the process. But this wasn't one of the recommendations that came out. And I understand your issue, and I do think it's a problem. And what some of the smaller boards said were there are people who manipulate the system because they understand the system, and these are people who they want to not have practicing, but they don't have they felt they didn't have the ability to go after them. But on the other point, I'm reluctant to do something that takes away someone's right to have an appropriate defense. So, I'm concerned that this might have unintended consequences, and I do feel like we're moving towards finding some other solutions that may address your interests. So I'm not inclined at this point to support the bill.
Chairs Greenlick and Thompson and Representative Foyle, I remember meeting with you that day, and it was a great meeting. This issue of the boards covering their administrative costs for contested hearings did not come up. We did speak on how do we get the attorneys, the right. board's attorneys, to be more knowledgeable so that we establish better relationships and get more accomplished in a shorter time. I think I just want to say that there are several boards that already have this authority, and I don't anticipate, and I would discourage our board from using it frivolously, as well as, like, the Board of Medicine has had it since 1996. They've used it in 3% of their cases. So, and in talking to the director, those cases were extremely frivolous cases. They were that insurance reimbursement issue. And the dentistry board has used it once. And they don't even use it for the entire, covering all the costs. It's just to help the board be able to sustain themselves. But because of our issue with this, I have a policy package in to increase our licensee fees. And I'm not looking forward to telling the licensees why I have to do that, but for the last 4 years, we've been using our cash reserves, and I've been pulling money from wherever I can to make sure that we can have hearings when we need to have them, and that we aren't afraid to contact our AG and ask her to come to our meeting and to help us decide how to go forward in a case where we really feel there's potential for future harm. And what do we do? How are we going to pay for that? And how are we going to make sure that we're actually fulfilling our mission without compromising every licensee's right? Every licensee's right is protected by law. And so
which means they can pay this and then go to appeals court.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I understand the licensee side of it, and your concerns for the licensee getting overcharged, or I don't know, a board potentially abusing the situation. But in the research I've done with every board that has it, most of them have not ever even used that authority. It's just, I think it's more of a key to help the licensee understand that you need to really feel like you have been wronged. And if you really feel that way, then you should be sitting down with the board and the board's attorneys to discuss this. And that's most of our cases settle because they feel like they've been wronged, and they will sit down with the board and they will sit down with our attorney, and we will come to a resolve so it doesn't have to go to a contested case. And
how about an amendment that would allow you to assess these fees in the case of contested case hearing? The administrative judge found that the case was frivolous on the part of the defendant. I wouldn't have a bit of problem with that. If you say it's only done in frivolous cases, I wouldn't have any problem with that at all.
Can't see any potential problem with that. I don't know if that puts a lot on the administrative law judge, but that's their job.
Their job is, yeah. I mean, but then you would say to the person, this looks to us like this is a frivolous thing. I mean, we could settle it. It looks frivolous. And if you send it and it's found to be frivolous, you're going to end up paying $50,000. I mean, that's a reasonable
thing to say. Right, Representative Greenlick, member of the committee. So I'm just wondering if you then aren't faced with how do you define frivolous? I mean, how do you, you know, at what point is, because the licensee, we have, if we are disciplining a licensee for charting and asking them to take continuing education classes, and I can tell you this for a fact, and they say, oh, no, no, that's I am not in violation of the law. Everything I did was fine. All we have asked them to do is to take some continuing education classes and have us check their charting for the next 2 years. And so I would think that would be frivolous.
I can tell you from a professional's perspective, that's a terrible blow for you to do that. And if they don't feel that they're guilty, I mean, that's really,
right.
That's not a minor thing. That's a really terrible thing. And if it was me and I really didn't believe you were right, then I'm going to fight you. Let's take this up with our attorney and see if we can...
Yeah.
See if we can.
I certainly understand where you're coming from. I like the chair's ideas, but I would also like to say, just in general, whether we're dealing with this, I would feel my, you know, I feel badly because you're out here on your own. There are other boards that have this. What I would feel more comfortable with is, one, going back, doing what the chair said, and also having an opinion from the executive directors, from the group. You know, you have there's a licensing board group, and I think that it would be stronger if we're going to do a change. Is this a change we should be doing for other boards, just like sort of in? I would feel better as opposed to having every single board come up, is to really hear in general if this is a change we should be making. Should we be making this across the board? And if not, why not? I think giving us some time.
Would you be willing to carry that to that?
I would be willing to do
that. You lost your sidekick. She's gone.
Yeah.
You're solo now.
Yep, I'm there. Okay.
That'd be really good. And let us check. In fact, you could check with your counsel as well. Well, not, it'll cost you money. We can do it free.
We have actually already checked with our legal counsel. We took this to her before we even presented it as a bill.
I was wondering the sense of adding... The limitation that it's if it was found.
Oh, that piece. Oh, that I didn't.
Great. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Representative Hoyle hit on a lot of the concerns I have, and I would like to see what we're doing with a lot of these boards, because as someone in a professional field and just to get hit, even though the board is your peers, to be hit with something like that right off the bat, it's going to hurt somebody, and it's going to hurt them bad, even if they're innocent of what's being said. So I would like to get some clarification, know what's happened on some of these smaller boards, what's taking place right now, and get some uniformity across all of them. So,
Senator Thompson?
One of the other things we probably should be looking at, too, is the exorbitant rate at which the Attorney General's Office cross-charges these boards and commissions.
I have had that conversation with the Attorney
General.
Somebody
must be making money somewhere.
And then the money doesn't go back to the board. That is a big problem.
Unfortunately, I don't think they are, but I don't know why not.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a conversation that I've had specifically with the Attorney General about the boards, which are... But he said he only raised his fee by $2 this year or something, an hour.
Because he's sitting on so much money from what he overcharged him from before.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. We'll keep working with you on this, and Representative Boyle will check in. And I think we really do want to defend against somebody that says, I don't care, I got $60,000 in malpractice, I'll take you on just to make your life miserable.
It works.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm just going to stay
here. Yep. The next bill is hers, too.
Oh, okay. So. Well, let's close the, where are we?
138.
We'll close the public hearing on 138 and open a public hearing on 139A. Welcome. Nice to see you again.
Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, you don't want to do your little...
This one.
Well, it allows the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Medicine to adopt rules relating to the applicant's retaking failed licensure examination. This has an emergency clause effective upon passage. There's no revenue or fiscal impact. The floor vote on this... off the Senate floor was 28 ayes, 2 excused. Thanks.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson. For the record, my name is Ann Walsh. I'm the executive director for the Board of Naturopathic Medicine. I'm here to ask your support of Senate Bill 139. It's 139A. It's simply a housekeeping bill. We historically, we, the board, administered the national exams as professional small, so we administered it for many years. And then in 99, a national association started to administer the exams, and in 2005, we took all of our authority to administer those exams out. But that one piece about limiting the number of retakes on the exams was left in there, which is just cumbersome for us because we don't regulate the national exams anymore. But we do need to be able to regulate the state exams, which we offer four times a year, and we want to be able to regulate whether or not how many times a person can retake those.
That piece was taken out, is what you're saying.
That piece was not taken out, but the piece was left in for us to regulate the national exam as well. So what we'd like to do is just take that out and put our authority into rules so we can just regulate the state exams as necessary.
Any questions?
Just one real quick. You're just saying here that the board may permit the applicant to retake the examination again in accordance with rule adopted by the board.
Right.
What would that rule be? Is it
Well, that's what we would, that's where we would write the rule that would be structured around when we Representative Widener, when we actually administer the exams and when a need comes.
Okay to work this one?
Yes.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 139A.
Great.
Open the work session on Senate Bill 139A. Mr. Co-Chair, do you have an amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 139A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Doherty?
Yes. Yes.
Aye.
Aye. Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. This really sounds like another consent calendar. But I think some people have a few problems and we put too many on.
I can stand up and say a good bill should pass.
Well, why don't you carry it? Okay. Let's have Representative Widener carry the bill. Shouldn't be a big contentious bill. Close the work session on Senate Bill 139A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 140.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Senate Bill 140 comes to you from the Senate floor with 19 ayes, 11 noes. This bill allows the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board to deny, suspend, revoke, or refuse to renew a license or impose probationary conditions if a licensee or applicant violates statutes administered by the board. It repeals provisions requiring the board to issue a warning before imposing a fine. It caps the fine that the board can issue to $1,000. It also allows the board to issue subpoenas without the signature of the chairperson. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. There's no there's no revenue, and there's a minimal fiscal impact on the bill.
Okay, let's see. We have Ms. Holgate and Mr. McCulley.
Chairs and members of the committee, Felicia Holgate, I'm director of the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board, another very small board, and our board's been looking about on our discipline part to see how we can be more efficient, and there were three changes we were looking for in our statute. The first is recommended by our Attorney General. Right now it says that unprofessional conduct must affect the health, welfare, or safety of the public, and she advised us, our Assistant Attorney General, that that is not in other health boards and that there may be things like not taking their pain management class that could be argued is not really affecting their welfare or health or safety, and that the law should just say any violation of statute or law, the board can find unprofessional conduct and discipline. The second change is very easy. Currently in the statute, it says that subpoenas have to be signed by the chair. We'd like it just to say the board can issue subpoenas. That way, any board or the board can assign that to the executive director. That's just kind of to make it simplify and not delay investigations. The third is really why the board brought this. Currently, the statute does have civil penalties for the Occupational Therapy Board. But it says that there has to be a first warning, and then there's a limit of 200, and then it goes up to 1,000. The first warning is the part that we have a problem with, because that would mean you'd give a first warning for somebody who didn't complete their pain management continuing education, and somebody also who stole money from a patient, although in that case we'd also suspend their license. But the board hasn't used civil penalties because of that first warning. We don't have that many cases, and it's very rare that we have the same occupational therapist before the board. So it really means we don't have the ability to use the civil penalties on a regular basis, because they don't come back for a second try. And that's the three. I do want to say that the no's on the committee, it wasn't on the committee, on the floor there were some no's, as Sandy said, but when I listened to them, I don't think they were opposed to this bill. It was general discussion about how health boards do or don't have civil penalties in general. I am glad to answer any questions.
Yeah, I'd like to ask if there's no other question. If you go to Section 1 of the statute, we're talking about the conditions under which you can discipline, right?
Yes.
And there are four different conditions that for which you can discipline somebody.
That's currently in the current law.
Well,
the only
isn't changing any of these things in the current law? This is just changing wording?
It's the other changes are just cleanup from legislative counsel's Part C. Sub C is the change where it says violating any provision of the statutes. And it takes out that may affect the health, welfare,
or
safety.
Any order, rule adopted by the board.
Right. So it doesn't change. It just takes out that that unprofessional conduct in here currently says that may affect the health, welfare, or safety.
Except A says committed unprofessional conduct as defined by standards established by the board. That can be independent
right.
of...
Well, our AAG recommended that it could be looked at somebody arguing, well, because I didn't finish my pain management, you don't want to issue my renewal to me, that has nothing to do with the health, welfare, or safety of the public.
To be slightly gross about it on the public record, the importance of what C is there was a dental practitioner who had complaints to the board from female staff in an office he worked that he had masturbated in his office with the door open and complained, and the board ruled that they had no authority over that as unprofessional conduct because it did not affect the health of any of his employees. This would allow you to censure that person even if you couldn't make the connection between his behavior and the health of the patient. That's what this would do, right?
I think knowing my board members, they might make a different decision and say that would be a violation under other parts of the statute.
They claimed they had no authority in that board, which I thought was very interesting. But anyway, this would make sure you have the ability to do that.
Right. Well, one of the possibilities. We also have John McCulley from the association here.
All right. We're going to hear from him now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley representing the Occupational Therapy Association of Oregon, and I'm here just to let the committee know that the professional association does support the bill. The board has been very forthcoming in discussing this issue with our membership, and we do support what they're attempting to do here and believe that it will strengthen the profession.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Okay, to work it?
Yeah.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 140. And open a work session on Senate Bill 140.
Chair Greenlech, I move that Senate Bill 140 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves Senate Bill 140 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Jordan.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Boyle.
Aye.
Representative Weiser.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cannon?
Excused.
Vice Chair Cannon?
Excused.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Greenlee? Aye. Motion passes. And since the occupational therapists are always mad at me for my outrageous statements, I'll carry this on the floor and see if I can get some brownie points.
Are you going to discuss dentists when you're out there?
That business about the dental associations, I mean, the dental board, is absolutely true, and I had this discussion with them, and they absolutely asserted it was not, they did not have the authority to censure that dentist.
That sounds a little odd.
Unbelievable.
Under employee relationship laws and whatnot.
They said they could take it to Bowley.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they said. They said it could have been under a hostile work environment,
yeah,
and they could take the Bowley, but the board could not treat that as unprofessional conduct. I'll take a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Parrish to vote. We've had a chance to talk about on Senate Bill 95A, which is the bill that... is it 95A?
No, 137.
I'm sorry. Hold the phone.
Mr. Chair, I make the motion that we suspend the rules to allow...
No. Wait a minute. Hold on.
She's the right one here.
On 95, we chose...
It is 95A that she didn't get to vote on.
No, we didn't.
None
we
of
didn't
us
take a motion
said,
on 95.
Mr. Chair.
It's just...
Access claim?
No, we didn't. We didn't move that one. We didn't
We were going to come back to move it when there were more people here.
Right.
Okay, I'll open a work session. That's what we need to do.
Okay.
Let's set up Bill 95A and ask...
Chair Greenlech, I move Senate Bill 95A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And you remember that's the motion that prohibits malpractice insurers from not defending a provider, hospital or others, because they have done what they should do,
right,
and admitted an error and apologized and said what they were planning on doing about it. Can you call the roll, please?
Representative
Boyle?
Aye.
Representative
Parrish?
Aye.
Representative
Boyle?
Aye.
Representative
Weiser?
Yes.
Vice Chair Cannon?
Excuse. Wait a minute. Not excuse. Say it again.
Wait. Just take a deep breath.
Aye.
Just say yes.
This is a good yes. Which is it? This is the bill that stops malpractice carriers from refusing to defend somebody who's admitted an error to the patient.
I'm sorry, Bill.
Medical marijuana and brownies.
I'm a yes. Okay.
To be distributed.
Yes.
In preschool.
Next.
Co-Vice
Chair Kennemer.
Excuse. Co-Chair
Thompson.
Aye. Aye. The motion passes. Who would like to carry this one?
I can do it. Hold
it. Representative Boyle. We passed, two or three others that are relatively pro forma. Would you like a chance to vote on them?
Which were they? And I'll tell you.
Okay. coming from the bottom, 139A.
Yeah, I mean, yes.
No, we didn't.
Did we do that one?
We just did 140, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
140, 137.
Let's do one at a time. You tell me which one he didn't vote on, and can I have a suspension of the rules first?
I was going to give that to you.
So moved. Okay.
Okay. And he just voted on Senate Bill 95, so we're good there.
We had a motion due pass on 137, which clarified the internship for the funeral service and embalming board, mortuary and cemetery board, that they must be supervised by a licensed practitioner of funeral service and embalming. So that, and Representative Cannon is shown as excused on that one.
Which are the others?
137.
Yes.
We did 139 as well, right?
No, 139 we did not do.
139. Yes, we did. 39A?
No, that's the one that has a contested case hearing, Mr. Chair.
No, it isn't.
No, it's renovation requirements.
Oh.
139A we did do. You're talking about 138.
Yes.
We did not do.
We did not do 138.
137, 139, and...
140.
And 140.
Which I just voted on.
Yeah, okay. The other two, do you want to vote on?
That's fine. Yeah, I'll vote on. Vote on.
What's your vote?
On 137, aye. On 139, aye.
Okay.
And on one... He came in on 95.
Right. Representative
yeah.
Parrish does
oh,
not
sorry.
Have 137.
Aye.
Okay.
Okay. And then Rep. Parrish needed to vote on 137. Thank you.
Is that true?
Yes.
Oh, I thought you only missed one.
I have Rep. Parrish.
Somewhere we have a scorecard.
I have Rep. Parrish as excused on 137.
Would you like to vote on 137, Representative Parrish?
Sure.
Okay. And your vote is?
Aye.
Okay. Okay. Close all those work sessions. Thank you all.
Are those the ones you opened, or?
Those are the ones that
suspended the rules.
That we took out of
the
rule, under the rule
that's
suspension.
Right. All the rules, yeah.
We are adjourned.
Wow.
This is your shortest attendance.